I like Disneyland. I'll admit it. I'm not shy. But what's the deal with Disneyland, people? I mean, seriously. Or as Seinfeld would put it, what is the deal with these Disney people? I have many a fond memory of Disneyland. Jesus, when I was in high school, I went there 4 years in a row. Does that put me in that same category? It is a pilgrimage of sorts. I was going there every, sometimes twice a year. I would be down in Anaheim, or in that area. I'd be at the Mount Sac Relays, Mount San Antonio College, incidentally where Sam Shepard studied. But Mount Sac, they call it Mount Sac, San Antonio College. They had a great relay race there. Excuse me. And some international runners would be there. Damn. And some of the events were real marquee events. The 10,000 meters was always a highlight. Pat Porter would run. That's usually where he would try and run as the fastest 10,000 of the year to qualify for, like, European races or the national championships or what have you. And every year you'd go there. Well, there was a cross-country race, too. In the fall, you go down there, and it was the hilliest race of the year, Mount Sac, the Mount Sac Invitational. And, I mean, it was all vertical. I mean, verticals, and it was ups and downs, very few flats. And so every year you'd be down there. First time, let's see, my freshman year, we went for cross country. Sophomore year, again for cross country. Junior year, I think that was track. We just went to the track meet. I don't think we went to the cross country. And then my senior year, I ended up winning the cross country invitational. We were in the senior race, not in the seated. Usually we'd run the seated men's race, which was all the stacked, all the really high caliber teams would be putting those races. But our better teams were my junior year. So our senior year, we would just ran the open men's senior invite, and I ended up winning that race for some reason. I don't know. It was a good race. And then right afterwards, we'd stayed at the Galaxy Inn, which was on, Catella is like the main, there's like the main drag in Anaheim, Catella, where Disneyland is on that street. And we'd be like literally in like walking distance, like half mile, maybe not even. We'd stay at the Galaxy Inn every year. I don't know, for whatever reason, we'd stay at the Galaxy Inn. You can just imagine, you know, the diamond-shaped plastic aesthetics of such a place, with glittery little backdrops and, you know, fascinating. Great place. And then you'd spend the rest of the day at Disneyland. And I remember my junior year, the guy that had won, I think it was a cross country, or no, my sophomore year. Yeah, it was my sophomore year, because we were there for cross country. The guy that won the invite, this guy, Paul Thomas, who was a great runner, he ended up winning the state championships in 3200. And was second in the 1600, I believe. He got beat in the 1600, but he won the cross country race. And then he got really drunk, and then he was acting like an asshole at Disneyland, so they threw him in Disneyland jail. That was the rumor. Which there probably is. There probably is a Disneyland jail. If you ever watch Exit Through the Gift Shop, the Banksy documentary, which is really fascinating. The guy, let's see, was it Banksy? Yeah. They put some kind of a street art piece in one of the, within one of the rides. Was it Small World? Might have been Small World. They planted some, it was kind of a protest statement of sorts. I'm trying to remember if it was like a black hooded piece that was, it was really an elaborate piece that had to be kind of composed on site, and then immediately security got wind of it, saw it, and they tried to find these guys, and then they found the guy. They tracked the guy down who was making the documentary, and they took him in for questioning because it was like this. You know, Disneyland is kind of like this. It's a little controversial. It's a controversial place. I mean, if you really think about it. Of course, Walt himself was an anti-Semite, but what are you going to do? Interesting cat. I mean, he really loved to entertain kids, but he was also anti-Semitic. I'm sorry if you're just now learning about this, but Disneyland has its detractors. But then it's got its cult following. It's cultish, man. There's people that just, you know, they're usually, I don't know if it's a mandated dress code, but they're usually wearing the, you know, maybe a Dale Earnhardt tank top, acid wash jean shorts, tube socks, New Balance shoes. They're a little out of shape usually. And they're kind of, it's a cult. It's a little bit of a cult. There, I said it. It's a cult. And there's nothing wrong with that. Pick your cult, right? I just got back from Naked Man. These people are, you know, at some point becomes one consciousness. We're all one consciousness. But then it kind of subdivides itself into different cultish aspirations, if you will. I remember one of my earliest vivid memories going down to Disneyland was, I remember I literally slept in the windshield, but it was the back windshield of a car. When I was like 5, and it had that hard cardboardish perforated kind of ventilated deck in the back behind the back seat, where the rear window angled down into that met the trunk of the car, and then there's a wedged in area where you could fit like in most cars, you could fit, you know, a towel or a cosmetic bag. But that's where they lodged me. And I remember waking up and having this kind of perforated dust pattern on the side of my body. And then I went to Disneyland and I walked around like that. I just remember tooling down the 5, like, each year of high school, at some point each year, we would drive down. I remember my buddy Eric, the SAC PD, the ex-SAC PD, his dad had a big Suburban. And so he would drive us, the runners, down to, if it was the cross-country race or the track meet, we'd all load up. The guy's team would load up in his Suburban and just haul ass down there. And then I remember, course, I was always the special needs kid in the back that had to go to the bathroom or was, you know, just acting like, you know, that kid, you know, that you kind of, you know, if I was a dog, they would have put one of those like lampshades on my head or something to kind of keep me from, you know, doing my self-harm. But I remember actually coming back one time, and my buddy Eric always had like these big jugs of water, big plastic jugs of water. They always drinking water, lots of water, which, right on, that's cool. We were coming back from LA and going north on the 5, and we had, it was warm. And I don't think there was any AC in the Suburban or what the deal was, but we had the windows down. And I was sitting up front. For some reason, I was probably under some kind of watch or patrol. And I was sitting, I was riding shotgun, and there was probably like 6-7 other guys, 8 other guys, strewn liberally throughout the rest of the Suburban. And Eric's dad's driving this thing, and I reach for this jug of water. I unscrew it and I start drinking, and it's warm. It's kind of like it's just been sitting there. And I look over at Eric's dad. I go, "Hey, this is warm." He goes, "Well, I'll just dump it out if you want." So as we're flying down the 5, I, you know, just roll the window down, and the rest of the Suburban windows are down, and I just dumped about, I don't know, it seemed like 8 liters of water out the passenger window that just consequently blasted through the rest of the opening windows of the Suburban as if we were driving through a car wash, and basically just soaked the living shit out of these 8 of these skinny-ass little high schoolers. And it was funny. It was stupid, but it was funny. You know, what do you expect? So I've got fond memories. Definitely have fond memories of my SoCal trips. A lot of SoCal trips. A lot of impromptu, or what seemed to be impromptu trips. I used to go, I went down there my junior year for the state championships. And just to watch, because I was a track head, you know. But I was hanging out with the coaches and stuff. And we had four coaches in one room, and me, of all things. They had the two beds. My coach, who was the distance running coach and the track coach for the distance team, then the field coach, Dave Underholzner, he was a high jump coach in field events. And then you had Joe Bonanno, who was also my biology teacher. And then Larry Fletcher, who was a field events coach and track coach. I think Bonanno was a sprints coach as well. And I remember they made a makeshift. They took like a lounger, like an outdoor chair or an outdoor lounge chair, and I don't think we put it on the we didn't have a balcony, or maybe we had a balcony and they threw it out there, and I slept on that. And then I remember falling asleep and started talking to my sleep and waking up, and those guys were all still awake, and they were looking at me like, what's with this tinfoil hat, skinny ass kid? But it was interesting. One of my more formidable memories of that particular trip, though, is we watched, I was obsessed with a senior girl that was running the mile in the state championships. Her name is Ann Kufalt, and I actually asked her to the junior prom. She went, but she wasn't into me. She was just like a really, really good, really good friend. But I went there to watch her run. Her brother was a state champion, Harold Kufalt. He ran 8:51 in the 2 mile. to win, and he also, did he win the mile as well? I know he won the, I know he won the 2 mile at the state championships, 1980 or 81. I think it was 81. Ended up going to Oregon on a scholarship. Qualified for the Olympic trials and the steeplechase. He was like an 8:34 steeplechaser. He ended up breaking 4 in the mile at Oregon. He's the head coach of our high school team now. But anyways, his younger sister was a year older than me. And so I went to watch her. And so we went into the stadium. This is down in El Cerritos College in Southern California. And the other coach, the girls' team coaches, was Rita Fagundes, man. She was kind of a bit of a cunt. And then her husband, Steve. Steve was a nice guy. Steve was an interesting dude. Kind of bland. Kind of like when White met Bread. But nicest guy in the world. Big Doors fan. Loved the Doors. Could tell you all about the Doors. But he was really kind of mild-mannered. Came off as very uptight. They were both kind of a little uptightish. She was real good to me though in pre-algebra, because she was my teacher in pre-algebra as well. But we went into the stadium. I took their cooler. I helped them carry their shit in, and I took their cooler, and it was a small little cooler. And when you got to the entrance of the stadium, you had to. If you had any glass, you couldn't bring in glass. So they checked your coolers, and they were parking their car looking for parking spots, and I had their cooler walking in with the other coaches. And when we got there, they checked the cooler, and they had a couple of bottles of like Calistoga water, some flavored water, in glass, of course. Like, you can't bring that in. And I'm like, oh, okay, what do I do? Well, you can just toss them out right here if you want. So I chucked their drinks in the garbage. And it was just spur of the moment reaction. What else? I mean, I'm not going to watch. It was a huge, huge, huge college. I got to track them down and let them know what's going on. So I chucked those things right in the garbage. When we got into the stands and they finally made their way in, they're like, where's our drinks? I go, I chucked them in the garbage. They were so shocked. They were borderline angry, and I didn't quite know how to react, because what do you want out of me? I'm 16 years old, and go fuck yourself. You know, I'm sorry. Fucking goons. Jeez, weird. SoCal and high school, and I think it was, was it the same? No, it was my senior. So my senior year, I actually competed in the state championships. So I ran the 2 mile in the state championships. My buddy Dave Welsh won, who was originally from Colfax and then got recruited by Walt Lang at Jesuit in Carmichael to come down to run for Jesuit, because they got all the good ones, you know. It was like Camp Mohawk in Meatballs. Like, we were Camp North Star, and they were Camp fucking Mohawk. So my buddy Dave went there. He went from being an obscure kid in Colfax up in the hills near Meadow Vista to this marquee runner. I mean, he was a badass. He doubled. I believe, did he double? No, he just ran the 3200. He won. He ran like 8:58, I think. Yeah. Good dude. Like, I'd hang out with him at running camps. And funny guy. He was one that kind of told me early on. He had a really he was kind of ahead of his time, too. Really smart guy. He said, I don't drink soda because it fucks with your O2 capacity, your the capacity with which you intake oxygen into your lungs. And this is he's telling me this is like a 16-year-old. And I was remembered that, like, you know, years down the road when I wanted to, like, just lose a little weight or something, you stop drinking carbonated anything, whether it's soda, beer, whatever. And it's true. Man. But he ended up winning the race. He ended up getting a scholarship, I believe, to Arkansas. And then I saw him run. Boy, what a difference a year makes. I watched him win the state championships in the 3200. And just smoked every, you know, he had good speed too. He was like a 412 miler in high school, I think. And then when he got to Arkansas, see, I don't think scholastically he was very good, because Paul Thomas, that maniac from that went to Disneyland jail, he went to Arkansas too, and Paul Thomas was about as dumb as you can get. Like, but Dave wasn't dumb. He just didn't have the same. He didn't have the grades. He just did. I think he just was like, I can't be bothered with this bullshit. But nevertheless, he did get a scholarship. And so my freshman year, when we went to the NCAA championships, and we ran the Division II in Pennsylvania, the Division I race was in Annapolis, Maryland. That's when I drove the rental car all over the tri-state area, zigzagged across the highway medians, and slept in a Safeway parking lot. And then we ended up watching the NCAA Division I race Monday morning at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. And man, he went from state champion his senior year of high school to an also ran in that race, the Division I champ. It was unbelievable watching the lead pack about five guys from, you know, there's like Bob Kennedy who had won it all the year before. Was it year before? Yeah, I think it was the year before he'd won it all. He was, as a freshman, won the NCAA Division I cross country championships for Indiana. And then the next year he was in the lead pack of about five guys as they crested through the mile at about, they went through by like at 429 or some shit. With there was a runner from Iowa and then a couple other guys, and then Dave Welsh was lagging way back in like 182nd place or something. And even the Masteliers were in there, the twins from Jesuit, that they were both on scholarship at Stanford, and Mark and Eric Mastelier, they were even way back in the pack. It's just a real humbling moment, you know, when you know, and particularly in California. Like, if you're in the state championships in California and you win, or you're in the top five, like, you could probably win just about any state championship. I mean, there's a few outliers, there's a few exceptions to the rule, you know, a couple of guys here and there back east maybe that could beat you or give you a good race, but all in all, if you win the California state championships, you can win any state championship. But it's just a humbling moment to go from top dog senior to, you know, also ran freshman. You know, and I did that. I was kind of a microcosm version of that. You know, I was in the top three in the section. You know, I got third place at Modesto Junior College at the section championships behind Dave Welsh and Damon Chamberlain, who. He ended up being like about a 9:12 2-miler. Dave Welsh won. Very tactical race. We all, I ran about 9:28 to get third. And it was everything I could do to get third, to qualify me for the state championships. But in a lesser sense, I ended up going to a Division II school. Had the same relative success that Dave Welsh did on a Division I scale. But it's very humbling. There's a lot of humility that you have to learn to acquire. You have to learn to acquire shovelfuls of humility as a freshman, unless you're like Bob Kennedy and win the NCAA Division I championship. But, you know, that was a freak thing. He ended up only winning one other NCAA championship after that. Only. I mean, shit. there's like 400 people in that race. I mean, it's an experience. Collegiate running, if you ever want to get humbled, try and run with the lead pack at the NCAA cross country championships anytime soon. So how that all relates to Disney, I don't know. It doesn't. Just some interesting times. Good times at Disney. But we're kind of like, it's cultish. It's a very cultish thing. Naked Man is like a cult. It's like Naked Man. It's like a cultish thing. It's like Scientology. It's like anything that brings together somebody in a single consciousness and forces them to wear acid-washed jean shorts should be deemed a cult. You know, NASCAR racing, Amway sales. I guess, I don't know. But So I've been dying to talk about this guy, Blake Edwards. Because we used to watch movies in college, after practice, or just kind of in veritable happenstance formation, we would be watching like Pink Panther. And I remember my buddy Jim Bowles, the great Jim Bowles, the school record, still school record holder of Humboldt State in the half mile at 150.1. We would be watching the Pink Panther movie series. There's a whole series. Of course, this is before a lot of people's time, but the Pink Panther was, before it was even a cartoon. Can you imagine, like, a cartoon inspired by a movie? But it's not, but it is. But it is, but it isn't. The same composer, Henry Mancini, did the music for both the cartoon as well as the movie series. But the movie series was back in the 60s. And it kind of made a star out of Peter Sellers. Peter Sellers was kind of this bit part. He was kind of like a Russell Brand type. You know, Russell Brand, when he was in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, he played Aldous Snow, the whacked out rock star that Sarah Marshall was banging. And the strength of that character was so strong. The writing of that character was so strong. It stood out so much in the movie that it created like a follow-up, which was Get Him to the Greek, which is a phenomenal movie. That's a great one. Get Him to the Greek. If you haven't seen that, it's, well, of course, it's Russell Brand playing Aldous Snow, but something of a, was it a prequel? No, it had to be not a sequel. It's just connected. And it had Jonah Hill, as well as Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Jonah Hill was funny in Forgetting Sarah Marshall. He plays like the sycophantic server who's just trying to like get on the same level as Aldous Snow because he's such a big fan. But in the movie Get Him to the Greek, he plays a somewhat sycophantic movie or a music it works for a label, and then he has to get Russell Brand to the Greek Theater in LA, but that's kind of what happened with Peter Sellers in the Pink Panther series. It was originally the first movie was The Pink Panther, which The Pink Panther is not a cartoon about a panther that's pink, although it eventually became one. It was originally about a diamond. It's the name of a diamond, or a diamond thief. And the star was David Niven, who went by the moniker the Pink Panther, who stole diamonds. Very, very, very stylized movie. Very, really good. Very European feel, or English. Very English. Had an Englishy European feel. And but Peter Sellers played this kind of bumbling Inspector Clouseau. And he stood out so his part was so strong that it garnered follow-up movies. Pink Panther Strikes Again, Return of the Pink Panther, A Shot in the Dark, all based on the strength of this secondary character. That was the genius of Peter Sellers, who was very, very, he had his own, he had a big following. He did he was a part of a comedy troupe in the UK. What was the hell the name? They did some, it was real dark comedy stuff. It was kind of very Monty Python-ish. I can't remember. I'm drawing a blank. But anyway, he came out of this improv group, this comedy troupe. And Peter Sellers was like he's a force of nature. Very, 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 very talented, though. So much so that we would quote him in the movies. You wanted to see him. You didn't. The rest of the movie was really kind of a byproduct of the performance of Peter Sellers. And there's so many quotable lines in there, you know? Like my buddy Jim would always be like, "Does your dog bat?" He had this weird, it was kind of like Peter Sellers was British, put on this funky, whack ass French accent, Inspector Clouseau. And he would, one scene, he was like, there's this dog there and this old lady, and he's like, "Does your dog bit?" He's asking the lady, "Does your dog bite? Does your dog bit?" And she goes, "No." And he reaches down and pets the dog. The dog just attacks him, just leaps at him, tries to bite his hand off. He goes, "I thought you said your dog does not bit." She goes, "That's not my dog." So good. But you got to give a lot of credit to the guy that came up with the whole concoction. That was this guy, Blake Edwards, an American director, making a film about a pink panther, which had nothing to do with a panther that's pink in a cartoon, set in England, and starring a British guy that's doing a French accent. So that's pretty brilliant. And it kind of, anyway, it kind of, like, Blake Edwards is, you don't really hear a lot of credit given to this guy. And he's done some phenomenal stuff. Not the least of which was the Pink Panther series. I mean, just brilliant shit. You know, the whole, the houseboy Cato. I mean, nobody knows what that shit is anymore. But, when Peter Sellers would come back to his house, he had this Asian houseboy named Cato, who was trained to attack him to keep him on his toes. So as an inspector in hand-to-hand combat, he had this houseboy that I don't know what his other function would have been other than to keep the house in order, because as soon as Peter Sellers got home, Peter Sellers was on alert. Inspector Clouseau, he was on alert. He'd walk through the door and Cato would be like hanging from the rafters of the ceiling, just waiting to pounce on him, just to keep him trained, just to keep him, his mental acuity sharp, so that so that he could refine his skills in the field, so Cato would like jump him and like come at him with like a samurai sword and like swing at him and miss him and take out the bedposts and, you know, fucking the curtains would be ripped to shreds and there'd be shit, holes in the wall, just tearing this place apart. Trying to get Clouseau, and Clouseau would come back at him, he'd try and karate chop him, and this is just what they did every time he showed up. It was the most bizarre, it was absurdist humor. It was fucking brilliant. And we would just laugh our asses off at the shit, but you don't hear much about that anymore, but it's brilliant, brilliant stuff. And it's very European feel, but so good old Blake Edwards, but he had a pretty good, good run with that Pink Panther series. The last few he didn't partake in, and they were awful. Curse of the Pink Panther. What was the other one? Revenge of the Pink Panther. They really milked the fuck out of it. But the last three he didn't have any part in. Matter of fact, Peter Sellers wasn't even in it. They spliced together a lot of footage for one of them of Peter Sellers, but it was so gratuitously awful. Anyway, if you ever indulge yourself, look at the first three, not the last three. But this guy, Blake Edwards, he was also the guy that did the movie 10, which, you know, people used to talk more about. And now it's kind of a bygone era. Like, Blake Edwards doesn't get the credit he deserves. Like, when you talk about American directors, you talk about the Martin Scorsese's, the Brian De Palma's, the Francis Ford Coppola's, the George Lucas's, the Steven Spielberg's, the greats, naturally, you know, but Blake Edwards is his own thing. He's his own niche. I've been wanting to kind of just delve into like his whole catalog, because he's such an overlooked talent, you know. He did this movie 10, which was Dudley Moore, another discovery of his. Well, he wasn't a discovery. See, Dudley Moore, again, was now probably the fresher version of, say, somebody like Peter Sellers. Peter Sellers was brilliant. I mean, that guy was, there was, Peter Sellers was kind of like a, he was a genius. He was one of those guys you talk about in the same breath as, say, like Andy Kaufman. People that just transcend the whole genre. But then you go to the next decade. Okay, so the movie 10 was Bo Derek and Dudley Moore. And it was just about this little runty little Englishman that becomes obsessed with this woman, Bo Derek, who now Blake Edwards is kind of, you know, elevated to, you know, star status. He's got, you know, Dudley Moore was the same deal. He was in an improv group and he did radio. Great comedian, fucking brilliant comedian. Great piano player too. He was actually a classically trained pianist. That sounds like a good joke. A guy with a classically trained pianist. But he basically discovered Bo Derek. So this was, who was just phenomenal. I mean, she still is. I mean, Jesus. I mean, that was 79. The movie 10, of course, referring to Bo Derek being a 10, because she was a 10. I would say a 10 and a half. With the cornrows and just the first white woman that stood out with cornrows. Just fucking just ethereal. But and then Dudley Moore was this little English pianist who both were just, you know, jettisoned into that was one of the highest grossing movies of 79, I believe. I think it was 79. Sounds about right, because I remember seeing it when it came out. Of course, I was always taken to, like, I think that's what's wrong with me, is I was taken to these movies, that, you know, 79, I was 8, and I'm watching Bo Derek. I think it was my dad. my dad couldn't watch these movies at home. So when we'd be out on the, like, he and I would go out of town to build houses, or he'd take me along with him during the summer. And I remember we lived in Ukiah once, he and I, for a couple weeks just to make some money. And we lived in an apartment that was being built. There was nothing in it. We just rolled our sleeping bags out on the floor of the apartment, and we would work in the apartment, building other apartments within this apartment complex. And we went out there for like a week or two. It wasn't very long. I just have strange, vivid memories. And this is Ukiah. This is like 3 hours from here. So obviously we weren't going to go back and forth. We weren't going to commute. So we brought our sleeping bags and we laid them out on the floor of the apartment, just him and I. And then after work, we'd go watch, well, we would watch the movies that he wasn't probably quite allowed to see in the same room with me and my sister, or even my mom, probably. My mom would probably give my heart, you know, she'd be like, John, we are not watching this in front of the kids. So on these out, on these out-of-town excursions, we would go see Stripes, you know, female mud wrestling in a movie like Stripes, you know, in 82. We see it at the theater. I'm 11 years old watching Bill Murray in Stripes, female mud wrestling, and Tarzan the Ape Man, which was, that was probably one of the gnarliest movies I've ever, that was 1980. So Bo Derek, this is the year after 10, and she was in a movie, she was married to John Derek, like that's where she obviously gets her name, and he was a director, and not a great director, an interesting director. John Derek was talented, but I think he was a voyeur or an exhibitionist of sorts, or he felt like he needed to make Bo Derek an exhibitionist for the voyeurs. So we made this movie Tarzan the Ape Man, which was basically, she was naked for most of it, and then in the end, and it had Richard Harris, so it's like, wow, okay, Richard Harris, one of the great English actors. It's like, okay, it's a legit, it's not porn. But this is 1980, I'm 9 years old watching Bo Derek, like, completely naked, being painted white by African villagers in the scene finale when the chief of this African tribe kills Richard Burton, who plays her father in the movie. She's Jane, you know, and in the movie Tarzan. And then Tarzan is played by this guy, Miles O'Keefe, who, you know, you just know, like, she gets fucked in the end. But, man, I'm like 9 years old watching this stuff. And so shout out to my dad for shaping me into the freak that I am. But anyway, yeah, Bo Derek, legendary Bo Derek. She, but in essence, Blake Edwards discovered her, because she was in this movie. I remember watching this movie. This was, she was in a movie in 77, again with Richard Harris, so strange, called Orca, about a killer whale. It was kind of billed as Jaws meets Moby Dick, and it didn't do very well. It didn't do very well at all. But I remember she had, in the movie, she played she was like disabled or something, or she was in a wheelchair, or she had a cast. And anyway, the killer whale, Orca, rams the side of the house that she's in, is like perched on like this wharf, and the killer whale dislodges the support beams of this wharf, this pier that the house is supported on, and then the house starts to kind of crumble into the ocean, and then the orca kills Bo Derek, and that was it. That was the whole, it wasn't very exploitative, but that was all she'd been in until 10. What a, and then the movie was so it had such an impact culturally, because they used that classic track Bolero by Maurice Ravel. Just great, fucking great, fucking piece of music. I mean, it's a classic piece, but on the strength of that movie that they use it in, they made another entire movie with Bo Derek a couple years later, after Tarzan the Ape Man, called Bolero, where she plays some Spanish object of beauty. And Ravel's Bolero is just soaked liberally through this entire movie. It actually climbed up the charts. The movie 10 did for Maurice Ravel's Bolero what culturally couldn't be done for a piece of classical music in forever. Yeah, it was just very interesting. Yeah, that's Blake Edwards. Great director. But that leads me to my... He did some real... brave, innovative, I don't know about innovative, maybe, bold character statements, you know, Bo Derek, of course, being one of them. But he did this movie, I remember watching this movie. This was we're in the 80s, probably. I'm like 11 or 12, and he did this movie called S.O.B., and it was a movie within a movie, and it was about this guy, this director, who is, it's probably a little autobiographical, because the first, God, it seemed like 20, 30 minutes of the movie, there's no dialogue, it's just this guy, Richard Mulligan, he plays this director, who I assume is probably autobiographically depicting somebody like Blake Edwards, who's kind of come to a moral bankruptcy or a occupational bankruptcy. He's burnt out. He's in this Malibu house. He's just been used by all these people. There's been a party. He's just kind of trying to figure his way. Just to sobriety, just to get a clear head to see what has become of his life and his work. And so there's no dialogue for, it seemed like 10, 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. The first 20 minutes of the movie, it just, Richard Mulligan is kind of wandering through his house like aimlessly, just trying to piece things together, figure out what had happened then to his life, or at least the previous night. What happens is he gets some inspiration after seeing the wreckage of his life. He gets some inspiration to do a movie. So he does this movie. So it's a movie within a movie. And, but the thing about the movie is you get to see Julie Andrews' breasts. Yeah. And at the time it was kind of I think it split the audience. But you get to see Mary Poppins' breasts. Like, Mary was popping. But it was weird. I mean, even at the time, like, as I watch it, and again, here I'm 10 years old, you know? I'm watching Mary Poppins do, you know, show her can-cans. So, I was just struck by it. I was fully aware of what was going on, and the juxtaposition of seeing I'd already seen Mary Poppins. I'm like, oh, that's Mary Poppins. Oh, and that's Mary Poppins' breasts. But it was very deliberate, and even upon reading up on it, it was really cool. It was really just a brave thing. And but surprising in every way. Henry Mancini did the music, of course. Henry Mancini is a great composer. He's the one that, of course, did the Pink Panther. But anyway, but that's yeah. You got to see Mary Poppins' breasts. You got to see the matriarchal Von Trapp woman from Sound of Music. The hills are alive with the sound of. You get to see her breasts. It's so weird. It was so weird. It was like a cultural, like, emergency break. You're like, whoa, what? Really? Did that just happen? And it was a buildup in the movie. There's a buildup. It's like you, like the penultimate point of the movie is, it's kind of a finale scene, and then she just whips him out, and you're just like, well, shit twice and fall back in it. That was incredible. And then you expect to go out, and then you're just expected to live the rest of your life. So, I don't know. It was good. But that leads me to my whacked out pick of the day. The whacked out movie pick of the day. Or the week. Or whatever. Where am I? And that would be the movie Skin Deep. Skin Deep. Saw it in college. It's not a phenomenal movie. Not in any sense of the word. But it is funny and it has its moments. And it's a Blake Edwards movie. And it's starring John Ritter as a bankrupt, bottomed out, drunk, alcoholic writer trying to piece his life back together, and all the funny little incidences in between. And there's even a sequence where two guys are wearing fluorescent condoms in the dark and having a sword fight. So just that scene alone is worth it. Almost. It's a good movie. It's a good, solid movie. And John Ritter does a great job in it. But that's Blake Edwards. And that's one of his last movies. He died, but what a impactful filmmaker. An American original. Blake Edwards. You know, virtually the virtuoso of... in the creation of da-dum, 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 da-dum. I mean, they use that shit in like insulation fiberglass ads now. He had chronic fatigue syndrome for whatever reason, but he was also married to Julie Andrews. That was his wife, who, you know, displayed her dueling banjos in one of his movies. Just wanted to yap about him, and then, so if you get a chance, it might not be easy to find. Well, shit, what am I saying? In this streaming age, you can find whatever you want in seconds. Not like it used to be back in the day when you're 8 years old, 9 years old, and Charlie Brown, the Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown, came on once on a Thursday night in October, and if you didn't see it, that was it. You gotta wait another year, bitch. But now, shit, with streaming, you can find anything at any time. And if you have to wait longer than 3 seconds, you fucking want to lose it, because we've got Starbucks on every 3 feet and we're over-caffeinated and we get what we want now, people, now. There's no wait period for this shit. There's no wait time. There's no wait time. Unless you're at Disneyland or you're Paul Thomas. You're sitting in Disneyland jail. Anyway, that's all I got for you folks today. Hopefully you came away with something. I don't know. Check it out. The Pink Panther series with Blake Edwards. The birds are waking up already, so I gotta go. All right. Love you guys. Talk at you later. Arrivederci, babies.